Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The insuperable ecstasy was so strong that the queens who were shy first embraced the Lord in the innermost recesses of their hearts. Then they embraced him visually, and then they sent their sons to embrace him, which is equal to personal embracing. But, O chief of the Bhrigus, though they tried to restrain their feelings, they inadvertently shed tears. Purport. Although due to feminine shyness, there were many hindrances to embracing the dear husband, Lord Sri Krishna, the queens performed that act by seeing him, by putting him in the cores of their hearts, and by sending their sons to embrace him. Still, the act remained unfinished, and tears rolled down their cheeks despite all endeavors to check them. One indirectly embraces the husband by sending the son to embrace him, because the son is developed as part of the mother's body. The embrace of the son is not exactly the embrace of husband and wife from the sexual point of view, but the embrace is satisfaction from the affectionate point of view. The embrace of the eyes is more effective in the conjugal relation, and thus, according to Srila Jiva Goswami, there is nothing wrong in such an exchange of feeling between husband and wife. Tamatma jayar drishtibir antaratmana duranta bhava parive bhive patim niruda ap yashravad ambunetrayor vilaj jatinam briguvarya vaiklavat. The insuperable ecstasy was so strong that the queens who were shy first embraced the Lord in the innermost recesses of their hearts. Then they embraced him visually, and then they sent their sons to embrace him, which is equal to personal embracing. But, O chief amongst the Bhrigus, though they tried to restrain their feelings, they inadvertently shed tears. So here we see, what is yoga? What is bhakti yoga? The word yoga means to connect. And here we see that the wives of the Lord were connecting with the Lord through embracing. And here they had three levels of embracing. They were embracing in their hearts. How could they do that? Because we learned from the previous verses that they were always in a trance of meditation on the Lord in their heart. So they could see the Lord in their heart. They could feel the Lord in their heart. Therefore, they could embrace him within their heart. They also embraced him with their eyes, which says here in the purport, according to Jiva Goswami, or maybe that part's not according to Jiva Goswami, but this embracing between the eyes is effective in the conjugal relation. It's a, Prabhupada uses the word sexual, it's a sexual embrace. And then they sent their sons to embrace him, which was an affectionate embrace. Of course, we may note here the use of the word sexual. Krishna produced many children from each of his wives, which is interesting because Prabhupada often inciting that the relation between Krishna and the gopis is not materially sexual, points out that the gopis never had any children by Krishna, nor did they have any abortions or use any kind of contraception to prevent children. And this is one of the evidences that Srila Prabhupada gives, that the relation between Krishna and the gopis is not material sexuality. However, with Krishna and his queens, he certainly impregnated each of them many, many times, and therefore we can also call that relationship, although it is purely spiritual, we can also term it sexual, and there, Prabhupada says, there's nothing wrong. That between Krishna and his wives, it's not that there's anything wrong in describing it like that. Of course, it's not sexual in the material sense of being concentrated on my enjoyment. We discussed that the other day, that lust is where I'm thinking, how can I get this person to satisfy me? And love is, how can I satisfy this other person? That cannot be artificially imitated. If we think I'm going to just work to satisfy this person and forget about myself, eventually we'll explode. Eventually we'll have a breakdown of some sort. We won't be able to maintain it. and we'll start demanding the satisfaction of ourselves because we're on a materialistic platform. So it can't be artificially imitated by one on a materialistic platform. But in any case, this relationship between the Lord and his queens at Dwarka is not in the category of material lust. It's not exploitive. It's simply loving. At the same time, it also is in the category of sexuality in the sense of having children, in terms of the sexual act, and that in the way that we understand it materially speaking, that the woman becomes pregnant, that she gives birth to the child, and so forth. That doesn't mean that Krishna has a material body. That's not what it means. But when Krishna comes to this planet and imitates earthly affairs, he acts as if he has a material body that grows and so forth. And that's part of his Nara Leela, his very sweet Leela like a human being. So this embracing between the queens and Krishna, which is the exemplification of yoga, although it appears from a certain point of view to be like the relationship between any wife and husband, still it is not happening on that platform. It's happening on the transcendent platform, that the queens want to love Krishna, want to embrace Krishna because their embrace will bring pleasure to the Lord, and he wants to embrace them because his embrace will bring pleasure to them. So this connection between the jiva and the Lord is the meaning of yoga. People may think that yoga means doing some exercises. The purpose of the hatha yoga exercises and the breathing exercises of pranayama, which, by the way, are supposed to come after yama niyam, that's supposed to come after a basic moral life. So first, you don't lie, you don't steal, you don't cheat, you don't have illicit sex, you don't eat animals, so many things. Then, after your body is basically clean, then you do the exercises and the breathing. Why? Because the exercises and the breathing put the body and the mind, the breathing particularly affects the mind, the exercises affect the particularly the body. It puts the body and mind in a state of stillness, that you can come to pratyahara, where you can withdraw the senses from other objects, and then you can engage in jhana, or internal meditation. So the exercises are not in and of themselves valuable. Of course, people still, because those hatha yoga exercises are designed to create a kind of stillness for the mind, and because the mind, being a product of the mode of goodness, is the happiest when it is still. Just stilling the mind, you can just still the mind, then immediately you feel quite a sense of peace. Any degree of stilling of the mind, one will feel very peaceful. Actually, the mind likes to be in that position. That's its natural position, you could say. The chanchala hi mana krishna, this jumping about of the mind, that is in contact with the material mode of passion. And intelligence, which is a product of the mode of passion, is directing the mind to jump about. Anyway, so people, when they do this hatha yoga and pranayama, they find some small extent, at least, of stilling of the mind, which gives them some happiness. And of course, because it balances the body, it brings them some health and so forth and so on. But it was not intended to be an end in and of itself. Just like the other day, I went to chant my japa down by the ocean. So just sitting by the ocean doesn't have any value, but it's a very peaceful place to chant. There's no distractions. So my grandchildren aren't running around or knocking at my door, and my computer's not there, and there's just nothing else to do. That it's a very good place to focus, just like, you know, we may have a temple room or a temple place in our house where we go to focus. So it's not that particular square footage of the room in and of itself, you know, if I just go to this room or I go to this place, or the early morning time of the day, for example, it also helps one to become still. But the purpose of that stillness is to create the connection. It's to create the connection. The essential thing is the connection. Or if you want the connection with another person, it's nice to have a time when it's just you and that person. If we really want to connect with somebody, it's nice to just be alone with them without a lot of other things to do. where we're giving them our full attention. We're going through a book on training children. And one of the things it suggests is that when a child is talking to you, that you stop what you're doing, if at all possible. I mean, you can't do that if you're deep frying flurries or something, but, you know, you stop what you're doing and you give that child your full attention. So these things that are called yoga in the modern age, they're an aid to giving your actual connection your full attention. So this is what we're looking for. We're looking for this connection. What the wives are accomplishing through embracing Krishna with their eyes, with their bodies, with their sons, is they're trying to achieve this connection. And if we analyze, really everything we do is to try to gain happiness and peace and understanding, right? Eternity, knowledge, and bliss. Eternity means peace and security. You're not threatened by harm or extinction. Therefore, you have peace and security. So we're trying to gain peace, security, knowledge, and happiness through connection. We're trying to connect even with material objects in order to gain understanding and in order to gain security. I try to have a connection with my home. Know what it is, where things are, how it works, so that my home can give me security. I try to connect with other living entities in the form of food. It's an interesting way of trying to have yoga. By eating the bodies of other living entities, then I try to connect with them in order to bring vitality to my body and pleasure to my body. Of course, the sexual connection, which is relevant to this verse, is also there. We try to have a physical, bodily connection through gross sexual intercourse. And we also try to have an emotional connection through subtle forms of sexuality, joking and affection. Here, Prabhupada talks about seeing through the eyes, right? Visual sexual connection. So we try to have pleasure and knowledge and understanding. We're trying to gain knowledge and understanding of the other person, to gain security that this other person, they'll take care of me. The woman is thinking, this person will take care of me. Even the man is thinking, my wife will take care of me. The children that are produced from this union, they will also take care of me. Or we try to connect with our government by getting involved politically, by fighting in a war. If you think about it, whatever we're doing, we're trying to establish a connection. And ultimately, of course, we're trying to establish a connection with Krishna. I really like the verse where Krishna says, I'm the mother, I'm the father, I'm the grandsire. And Prabhupada explains that actually our mother, our father, everything is nothing but Krishna. Maya tatamidam sarvam jagadav yakti murchina matsani sarvabhutani. Although we don't see Krishna there personally, it's all his energy. Ahankara, everything. It's Bina, it's separated energy, but it's really Krishna. We are trying to connect with Krishna. Of course, we are trying to connect with Krishna the wrong way. We are trying to connect with Krishna the wrong way. If you think about, say, husband, wife, or two friends, or parent and child, if they try to connect with each other by fighting with each other, this is a very interesting phenomena. And for various reasons, I've had occasion to meditate on this for the last few days. So let's say that someone's upset. Person A is upset. Oh, why didn't you do this for me? And person B wants to have a connection with person A. So they do this by saying, well, it wasn't my fault. This happened and this happened and this happened. Actually, it was your fault. Now, what are they trying to accomplish by doing this? What they're trying to accomplish is the other person will understand them, will understand their motives, will understand their situation, and will say, oh, I see that really your actual motive was that you just wanted to connect with me. That's what they're looking for. But of course, that's not what happens. Then the other person, instead of hearing that person A, instead of hearing that person B wants to connect with them, Here's that person B is attacking them. Then person A says, what do you mean it was all my fault? What do you mean you had those circumstances? You could have done it if you wanted to. And what is person A really asking for? They're really asking for a connection, for person B to say, yeah, I really did want to. And instead, person B goes on the defensive, and so on and on and on and on and on it goes. So unfortunately, I've been privy to some emails like this lately from some people, just blaming, criticizing. And I thought if you go underneath that kind of thing, you see that what they're really saying is, please understand me. Please have consideration for me. Please love me. Please connect with me. That's really what both sides are saying. But when they do it in that way, when they do it in a way that I'm right and you're wrong, and without any humility, without any honesty, really, then instead of a connection being established, a disconnection happens. So that's also our situation with Krishna. Instead of trying to connect with Krishna in our natural way, through honesty and humility, and as his energy, we are trying to connect with Krishna as if we are the energetic and he is the energy. And so, of course, that doesn't work. He's not willing to have a false relationship with us. He's only willing to have a relationship with us based on truth. Therefore, although we get a small amount, just like in fighting and blaming, there's some kind of ghastly, perverted humor. By humor, I mean enjoyment. There's some sort of perversion of a ghastly rasa that brings some sort of something. As Prabhupada says, a drop of water in a desert. There's something. We will not deny that there's something. There's some sort of feeling of energy in trying to connect with someone you like or love through blaming and fighting. But it's actually mostly frustrating. If you're extremely thirsty and somebody puts a drop of water on your tongue, it is more maddening than satisfying. It's almost as if you're better off with no drop of water on your tongue. So our trying to have this connection with Krishna in the wrong way, it brings us simply frustration. It's just maddening. Why isn't this working? And of course we get angry at Krishna, we get angry at other people, we get angry at material nature, we get angry at ourselves, and try to force a connection in the wrong way. You know, it's like these plugs. When you plug something into an electrical socket, at least in America, one side of the prong is larger than the other. If you try to force it in backwards, you know, you're just simply going to be frustrated. That's all. You know, or if you play with electricity in India, interesting, in India, the electricians work on the wires when they're live. And of course, it's 220 volts. So you do something the wrong way, instead of getting power for your air conditioner, you're just going to get, you know, you'll get some power. You'll get some power, but it will be just painful. So when we try to connect in the wrong way, there's something, there's some power, there's some energy there, but it's just painful. It's not really satisfying. So we know when we go to real yoga, real connection, just like material connection, doesn't mean I lose my identity. The connection I want to have with my son, with my husband, with my wife, with my friends, with my guru, with the people I work with my dog, with the trees outside, with the ocean, whatever. The connection that I want to have is not a merging of identity. I don't want to merge with the ocean. I don't want my friend and I to become one. Right? That's not pleasurable. What's pleasurable is that we have a connection, a deep connection, while retaining our identity. If we didn't retain our identity, who would enjoy the connection? If I connect with you so much that I cease to exist as a separate person and you cease to exist as a separate person, then who is enjoying the connection? There's no identity left to enjoy the connection. Who is going to experience the bliss? You know, like that absurd question, if a tree falls in a forest with no living entity to hear it, does it make a sound? Now, what is the, so whether it makes a sound or not, what is the use of it? What is the value? So therefore, this yoga with Krishna, this union with Krishna, means that Krishna remains and I remain, and we are relishing that connection. Although it's such a connection that one forgets oneself. That's part of the happiness of that connection. It doesn't mean that one ceases to exist. But if the connection is done in love, part of love is I forget myself. I am just giving fully to the, I am so connected that I'm giving fully to Krishna. Fully. I'm giving Atmanivedanam. I'm giving my very self. And it's such a giving that I lose control. Like here, the queen. It says that they were really trying. Right? They were really trying to restrain their exhibition of love. Why is that? Well, you might say, well, why would you want to restrain that? Why wouldn't you want to show your love? And here it's due to their natural shyness. Vilajjatinam. And we find that even the females, materially speaking, have a natural shyness, even among the animals. Now, this shyness does not mean this is not like a personality type. Just like according to personality studies, there's introverts and extroverts. There's people who get their energy mostly from dealing with their outside environment, and there's people who get their energy mostly internally. And this is not talking spiritual or material either. It's not that the introverts are more spiritual. That's not true either. But just how one prefers to relate. You know, just like when we go to, when we're giving workshops or seminars with a large group, or whenever you're in a large group of people, you'll find there's certain people who do most of the talking in the group. We've all had this experience, right? You have a group of 30 or 40 people working on something. There'll be just maybe 5, 6 people who do most of the contribution. And there are some people who won't say anything in a large group. And what's interesting is when you break into smaller groups, if you break the group up into groups of 4 or 5 people in each group, the same people who wouldn't speak in the large group often become the most vocal in the small group. So I'm sure you've all had this experience. You've met somebody who in a large group of people didn't say anything. And if you talk to them privately, they might talk your head off. So that's the personality trait. Of course, we have different personalities in different lifetimes, just like we have different bodies in different lifetimes. But that's a personality trait, that some people are more outgoing and some people are more reserved. And one is not better than the other. One is not more spiritual than the other. You can become a pure devotee of Krishna if you're outgoing, if you're reserved, and anywhere along the continuum. So this shyness of the woman is not like that, because just like in modern personality study, there are the extrovert and introvert is equally distributed among males and females. There are as many reserved men as there are reserved women, and there are as many outgoing women as there are outgoing men. This is not a gender-based consideration at all. There's no difference between the number of men and women who are outgoing and the number of men and women who are reserved. So therefore, that's not the kind of shyness this is speaking about. But there is a sort of shyness that is particular or peculiar to females, and that is a reticence, a reluctance, a hesitation of expressing a loving feeling, particularly conjugal or sexual feeling. So that in, I'm not sure if it's every single species, but in every species that I'm aware of, it's the male who takes the initiative, and often the female who runs away. You see this often in the animal kingdom, that the male has to chase after the female in order to mate with her. Among the birds, the males are putting out a display. They're, again, initiating. Among the frogs, it's the males who are croaking. And my son told me something interesting the other day from material psychology, that, of course, the woman knows that the baby is hers. She's the one who carries it and gives birth to it. But how does the man absolutely know? I mean, unless modern day you take a DNA test, how does he know? So the man is very interested in the woman's loyalty. If the woman's loyal to him, then he can understand that most likely the child is his. And of course, if the child is his, he's much more likely to take care of the woman and take care of the child, which is necessary for the woman. It's hard for the woman to take care of the child by herself. So therefore, in every society, the sexual chastity and purity of the woman is considered more important than the purity of the male. Although in Vedic society, the men were expected to remain celibate until marriage. It's not that the men were allowed. But still, the value put on the purity of the woman in every society that I'm aware of, perhaps there's one where it's not the case, is always higher. And the concept of the woman's loyalty to the man is also always higher. So this is so the man can know that this is my child and he will take care. So another way, my son was telling me, that the man has some idea that this is my child is that the woman is difficult to conquer. She's not easy. It's not that he can just go to her and immediately she'll have a sexual relationship with him, but she resists it. This very resistance, that actually Rupa Goswami explains in Ujjvala Nilamani, that the resistance of the gopis to having a relationship with Krishna is one of the sources of his happiness. So this exists even spiritually, where there's no condition of birth, and it has its original, has its origin there, although here in this world, we explain this phenomena in terms of biology. So it's not only a biological thing, but it's also the reflection of the spiritual. But anyway, biologically, the man understands that if this woman is hard for me to conquer, if she's hard for me to get, it will also be difficult for other men to take her away. That if she's easy for me to conquer, talking about by conquering, I don't mean something forceful or violent. By conquering, I mean that the woman will agree to having a sexual relationship with him. So if it's difficult for me to get her to agree, then once she's mine, once she's my wife, it'll also be difficult for other men to get her to agree, and therefore she's more likely to be loyal to me, and if she's more likely to be loyal to me, the children are more likely to be mine, etc. So therefore, the females are endowed with a natural shyness, a natural modesty, a natural disinclination to reveal their conjugal feelings and to act on their conjugal feelings. There's a kind of slowness and a kind of break and stopping in the female, which is one reason why I've seen among devotee women particularly that often it's difficult for devotee women to acknowledge or admit their own sexual feelings, especially in the modern day when women are exposed to a lot of propaganda from the society in general, either to marry very late or not to marry. And due to this propaganda and the natural modesty of women, the woman may think, oh, I really don't need to get married. I'm a renunciate. But generally speaking, the so-called renunciation of young women is really just a combination of modern propaganda against early marriage combined with the woman's natural innate sense of shyness and modesty, a natural break. So these transcendental women, these transcendental queens, they also have this natural shyness, this natural modesty, which is very attractive to Krishna. Krishna very much enjoys it, and they are exhibiting it specifically for his enjoyment. But because of this shyness, they're trying to stop their exhibition of feeling. They're not going personally to embrace their husband. They're just standing there. There's a beautiful painting in Prabhupada's quarters at Bhaktivedanta Manor of this verse where the women are just standing there. The wife is just standing there and Krishna is embracing the young son while Krishna and his queen are gazing in each other's eyes. It's beautiful, beautiful painting. So they are, although the woman wants more than anything else to go and as Prabhupada say, complete the act, right? He says here, finish the act. He said, still the act remains unfinished. So although the woman wanted to finish the act of embracing by walking up to Krishna and hugging him, due to their feminine modesty, they just stand in one place and they embrace him in their hearts, with their eyes, and with their sons. So let's look at these three kinds of embracing now. So in the heart, embracing in the heart, as we said earlier, that the queens, the reason that they could embrace Krishna in their heart is that they were already meditating on Krishna in their heart. That any time that the Lord was absent from them, they were in a trance. And they were constantly seeing the Lord in their heart. Some other examples of embracing in the heart was done by the gopis at Kurukshetra. When Krishna met the gopis at Kurukshetra, there were so many other people around. Actually, the gopis first came when Krishna was with Yasoda and Devaki. That interesting conversation, which we don't have time to get into now, between Yasoda and Devaki. And Krishna saw that the gopis were there. So because there were other people around, they embraced Krishna within their heart, and it says Krishna reciprocated. And he was embracing them back in return within their heart. And then they went off someplace alone to talk. But of course, at no time in Kurukshetra could they engage in the sort of pastimes that they engaged in Vrindavan. It was a holy place. There were so many other people there. It just wasn't appropriate. And therefore, emotionally, the residents of Vrindavan wanted to bring Krishna back to Vrindavan. They knew that only in Vrindavan could Krishna enjoy in the way that he most likes. Only in the form of Nanda Nandana and not as Dwarkadish. So that was their mood. So that was their mood at Kurukshetra. Another place I can think of where there was embracing the heart is with the wives of the brahmanas. That when the wives of the brahmanas came to see Krishna to give him some food, so Krishna did not want to have a relationship with him like but with them like he did with the wives of the cowherd men. The acharyas explained that he felt for him to have a relationship of parakiya ras with Brahmin's wives would be too socially criticizable, but that he didn't want to go, he didn't want to do that. But again, the wives of the brahmanas, they were embracing Krishna within their heart, and again, Krishna reciprocated with them and embraced them within the heart. Then embracing with the eyes. So this is throughout the Bhagavatam and the writings of the Goswamis. There are so many examples of where Krishna and the gopis, Krishna and Radharani especially, are embracing each other with their eyes. So then sending the sun. The example I could think of, another example of sending the sun was with Maharaj Prataparudra and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, as a sannyasi is forbidden to have anything to do with money and women. Right? Money and women. So why is that? Because, again, our mentality in this world, like we started off saying, that materially means you're trying to have yoga with Krishna in the wrong way. That's what material life means. So we could also say trying to have yoga with Krishna in the wrong way. That means I'm trying to be the enjoyer and Krishna's, I'm trying to make Krishna the enjoyed. I'm trying to take the position of Krishna. So what does Krishna enjoy? Krishna enjoys, like here, the queens. Krishna enjoys the queens of Dwarka, the Lakshmis of Vaikuntha, the gopis of Vrindavan. So who is that? What do we say Lakshmi? Lakshmi Sahasra Satasam Brahma Savior Manam. Lakshmi means what? Means wealth, opulence. But particularly, right, Krishna is enjoying through a conjugal relationship, enjoying the beauty of Lakshmi, the beauty of Radharani, And he's also enjoying all the opulences. We were reading in the previous verse how the opulence of the palace is with marble and gold and so forth. So these two things, sex and money, when I was studying from in my graduate degrees, I had to do a report once on the financial officers of at least 8 school districts. I interviewed all the financial officers, and I remember one of them telling me that whoever is handling the money has to be so careful because there are two things, two kinds of scandals that bring down a leader, sex and money. And Prabhupada talks about this a lot, right? He says the conditioned entity is naturally going to be, as Prabhupada says, restless in the company of women and money. So a sannyasi is especially giving this up, sex and wealth. And a king exemplifies this, sex, wealth, power. A king is in the position, a government leader is especially in the position of being an Ishwara. Even to be a government leader, as we were saying the other day, you have to have Ishwara above. So the sannyasi avoids particularly those people who are very concerned with sex and wealth and with controlling the world in that way. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu refused to meet Maharaj Pratapurudra, although Maharaj Pratapurudra was actually a Vaishnava. And at one point he agreed, I think on the urging of Advaitacharya, that Maharaj Pratapurudra's son could come see him because the son represents the father. Here in today's verse, today's purport, Prabhupada says that the son represents the mother. Of course, son represents either, right? Other places he talks about in the punishment of Ashwatthama, how Draupadi understood Ashwatthama to represent the dead Dronacharya. And therefore, Kripi, his mother, Ashwatthama's mother, did not commit sati because she had the representative of her husband, her son, was there. So as Pratapurudra's representative, the son came to see Mahaprabhu. And as soon as Mahaprabhu embraced Pratapurudra's son, that boy became a fully self-realized person. Overnight, immediately. It was one of those rare cases of Kripa Siddhi, where he immediately became enlightened. And then by Maharaj Pratapurudra seeing his son, he felt that he was in the association of Mahaprabhu. So that's an example of embracing the son, acting as a personal embrace. And then physical embrace, of course, we have the physical embrace between Radha and Krishna. Prabhupada also says, though, that Krishna embraces the cows and the calves. And he says there's no difference. Can't say that Krishna embracing Radharani, that's the only thing that counts. No, Krishna also embracing the cows, there's an exchange of love. If so many paintings like this, Krishna embracing his calf or Krishna embracing his deer. Of course, Krishna embraced Mother Yasoda. She's often holding him to her chest and they're embracing. Krishna embraces Gopakumar in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita when Gopakumar enters Goloka Vrindavan. So Krishna comes and embraces him. And then Krishna faints in ecstasy. Like here the queens are trying to restrain their exhibition of love, but they can't. They're loving so much that they're crying torrents of tears. So Krishna is also like that. When he's embracing Gopakumar, he's crying torrents of tears. Someone else who embraces Krishna is Kaliya. And Sanatana Goswami says that Kaliya's embracing of Krishna was anubhav, was an expression of ecstasy. He's the only acharya who says like that, but still he does say that. Of course, Chanura and Mastika also got to embrace Krishna and Balaram in Mathura, although they did not do so like Kaliya. They did not do so out of love. They did so out of enmity. But still, they got to embrace Krishna, and therefore they became liberated. So this attaining of yoga is means embracing the Lord, giving ourselves to Him. I give myself to Him for His pleasure. And that's what we should be doing. No matter what we are doing externally, if I'm out on the street distributing books, if I'm writing books, if I'm cleaning the house, cleaning the ashram, washing clothes, cooking, brushing my teeth, what to speak of when I'm chanting in japa or kirtan, when I'm taking care of the deities. I am doing all these things in order to have yoga with Krishna, just like we were saying at the beginning, that the purpose of the so-called yoga, the hatha yoga, the asanas and the pranayams, is simply to have a platform in which real yoga can take place. So all of the activities that we're doing, it's just to create a platform. Even in the Loka Vrindavan, the lilas themselves, who did this, who did that, who said this, who said that, they are to provide a platform for an exchange of love. So this is what we should be working on. This is what bhakti yoga is. Bhakti yoga is wanting to have this personalistic union with the divine. And we can do this even as a neophyte, just by thinking, Krishna, I'm doing this to connect with you. That, oh, Nanda Maharaj, you pick me up from this ocean of death. Let me have my connection with you. Let me be even just there touching your lotus feet. Somehow or other, let me be even a particle of dust. Or let me be your kinkuti, your maidservant who's serving your lotus feet, who's massaging your lotus feet, who's putting your ankle bells on. Some kind of meditation like that. That all I, and I, and I'm going to give up my false yoga. Nadanam najanam nasundari kavitamba jagadisha kamayi mama janmani janmanishware bhavatad bhakti hoitivitwe. I'm going to stop trying to have yoga in the false way. You know, like if you're counseling husband and wife who are fighting, you try to get them to see, wait a minute, what you're really trying to do is connect with each other. Why don't you just actually connect with each other through honesty? You do it. But you can't connect with each other through honesty when you're being dishonest and trying to connect in a ineffective way. You have to stop the blaming and the defending in order to have real connection. So we have to stop the trying to control material energy in order to have our real connection with Krishna. Therefore, we say humility is the doorway. Like, you know, Tekur says, this is the doorway into liberation, nishtha, and actual levels of bhakti. And of course, the prime way in which we are going to be able to do that in all our activities is by this hearing. This hearing is the means by which we will have the knowledge, the model, the ability, the enthusiasm, in order to make it so that when we are washing the dishes, when we are driving the car, when we are chanting the holy name, we are doing so with the mood of wanting yoga with Krishna. And here it's interesting, this verse, Bhrigu Varya, the chief of Bhrigu. So this is still conversation between the rishis. It's at the end of the first canto that Sukadev Goswami comes and is speaking to Parikrit Maharaj. So this is all the Bhagavatam. It's a conversation within a conversation within a conversation. So this is Sutta Goswami speaking to the sages at Nandasharanya, and within there is becomes the conversation of Parikrit and Sukadev Goswami. Within that comes the conversation between Vidura and Maitreya, between Kapila and Devahuti, between Narada and Pachimibarishat. All these, there's like a concentric and overlapping circles of conversations, which, by the way, according to modern psychology, is one of the main ways of creating a metaphor or a story that is able to affect a change in the other person's consciousness and behavior with layers of story. But as we absorb ourselves in these layers of stories of the Bhagavatam, then we associate with people who are experiencing this yoga with Krishna. Within the story itself, like the queens and the sons, the person who's telling the story, like Sutta Goswami, Sukadeva Goswami, the person who's done the translation, Srila Prabhupada. Or, you know, if we're reading Chaitanya Charitamrita, who are we associating with? Krishna Das Kaviraj, Shaimakun. You see, Krishna Das Kaviraj's Bhajan Kutir. It's right next to the Bhajan Kutir of Raghunath Das Goswami. Raghunath Das Goswami had kept diary when he was in Jagannath Puri. Plus, there were the diaries of Swami Damodar, and from Navadvipa, there were the diaries of Murari Gupta, which is one reason that Murari Gupta, if there's a short list of names mentioned to whom we owe our respects, Murari Gupta is in that list, because without his diaries, we would not know much about Mahaprabhu. So Krishna Das Kaviraj, using these and speaking directly with Raghunath Das Goswami, so he's writing the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So when we're reading Chaitanya Charitamrita, we are associating with Srila Prabhupada, who translated it and purported it. We're associating with Krishna Das Kaviraj, who wrote it, with Raghunath Das Goswami, who is none other than Rati Manjari and the chief assistant of Srimati Radharani. Plus, we are associating with Swarup Damodar, who is none other than Lalita, who is Radharani's most dear confidant, and Gauranga Mahaprabhu. And we are understanding what is this exchange of love, what is this yoga, because Mahaprabhu especially exemplifies the yoga between ultimately Radha and Krishna, and how all of the other jivas and energies contribute to that. So by hearing Chaitanya Charitamrita, by hearing Bhagavatam, we are immediately in association with every level, with God himself, with his topmost energies, with his topmost devotees, all the way down the parampara. And by that hearing, then we can understand how to act, how to think, how to emote, how to feel, how to speak, so that our entire life becomes one of yoga, one of connection. And then even if apparently we're in this world, we will always be at least embracing Krishna within our hearts. And at some point, after embracing Krishna within our hearts, then at some point, as it says here, the act remains unfinished. We'll feel that separation. We'll feel this act is unfinished, just embracing Krishna within my heart. And in that intensity of separation, Prabhupada says, then we will meet Krishna face to face and see him and talk with him and touch him and have yoga with him in a way dependent upon our sidebar. And that is the perfection of bhakti yoga. Thank you very much. I don't have a whole lot of time for questions today. Maybe have like 10 minutes if anyone has a question.
Okay, I've unmuted everybody on free conferencing. Please remain muted unless you have a question or comment so others can ask. But please go ahead.
Hare Krishna, is somebody responding first, or I can?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mataji. This is really very nice class. It's not an easy topic, but you are quite expert at that anyway, because of your studies. You mentioned something like, so chastity of a woman is very important, but I wanted to share something that there is a verse, or several times it's mentioned that men, or and especially Kshatriyas, have to be very careful where they deposit their semen. So even if a drop of semen drops, you know, we have the examples in the Bhagavatam, then they actually hold it in a place. What was that? I'm not kind of coming, but it's not kind of coming to my mind right now. A drop of semen fell, so they hold it in a pot, and then, you know, a living entity comes out from that and taken care of nicely.
Those are two different principles. Hmm. We're speaking on two different levels here completely. So one level is that the sexual energy of either a man or a woman should be used primarily for nourishment of one's own body and mind, and for giving that energy. What is sexual energy? It's an energy of wanting connection with life, of creating life, of joy, that that's meant primarily for our relationship with Krishna, and the physical manifestations of it should be dealt with very carefully. So that's one point. That's a different point. That's a different perspective. The perspective I was speaking about was, shall we say, on a lower level, was on a much lower level. And that is that for a man to feel inspired and enthused and inclined to protect a woman with whom he has sexual relations and to take care of the children, he wants some assurance that the children that she's produced are his children. That most men are going to be much more enthused to take care of a child if it's their child. It's just natural, just like you're more inclined to take care of a car if it's your car. I mean, there are some very liberal and open-minded men. You know, they adopt children or so many things. But generally speaking, proprietorship turns sand to gold. If it's mine, I feel more enthused to take care of it. And how does a man know that the children that his wife has given birth to are his children? How does he know? And one way he knows is the fact that the woman is loyal to him. One way he knows that the woman is loyal is that she's not so easy to convince to engage in conjugal affairs. And he figures that if she's not so easily available to him, she's also going to be not so easily available to others, that she'll be harder to conquer. And this hard-to-getness of a woman and this shyness of a woman gives the man some confidence that she's actually faithful to him. So that's on a completely different... We're talking here about human relationships on the level of the mode of passion. So what I was talking about in terms of the function of female modesty is from the perspective through the lens of human relations in the mode of passion. Whereas what you're talking about is through the lens of human relations in the mode of goodness or transcendence. And discussion there is about something quite different.
And also there is the other point, like you mentioned about the woman's loyalty, and you explained it very nicely twice here. The other point is the ownership, because as you know from the Vedic culture, and it is still very current, not only Vedic culture, Iranian culture, Chinese culture, it's still very current about the ownership. Obviously may go side inside with the loyalty, but the ownership is the main. Of course, there's the second principle, or another principle is where they want to continue with their dynasty, the name of the family, thus exactly. The ownership.
Exactly. So all of those impetuses are there to bring people to the path of Dharma. Dharma starts at the mode of passion. In the mode of passion, there's Dharma, but for the purpose of ownership and prestige and glory and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and sense gratification. In the mode of goodness, there's Dharma for the purpose of liberation, salvation. And in transcendence, there's Dharma to please Krishna. But Dharma starts with the mode of passion. So there's...
So even owning the children, or even having the children, it helps with the point of liberation, because Vedic culture mentions that having the children is to help liberation for the forefathers, and the duty of a son to... the person or the parent owes that to the family to bring a grandchild who will help with the liberation. So that is also another factor. Seriously. I'm just trying to bring out a lot more points in the point that you already mentioned.
I think that's very nice. I think it's good that you broadened the topic and looked at more points. Just we should understand that there's what lens we're looking through. When we're discussing a particular topic, we can look at it from many different angles. Just like Krishna told Arjuna first, he said, you know, you have to fight because you're an honorable person, and for one who's been honored, dishonor is worse than death. So you want to fight this battle so you won't be dishonored. And then, you know, right afterwards, he said, don't worry about honor and dishonor. Just fight for the sake of fighting. Don't consider honor, dishonor, gain or loss, victory or defeat. Forget about it. And then a little later, he says, you know, if you're really going to do this, do it as a sacrifice for me, for Vishnu. And later on, he says, those who are really dear to me don't care about honor or dishonor. So Krishna was giving reasons to fight from many levels. So his reason to fight for the sake of honor was a reason in the mode of passion. His reason to fight as a sacrifice for Vishnu so he'll get mukti, that's a reason from the mode of goodness. And the reason he's giving in the 12th chapter that my devotees are very dear to me, we're above honor and dishonor, that's from the point of view of transcendence. And therefore we find Yagyarchar Kamanonatra, that verse is in the 3rd chapter having to do with karma yoga, whereas the other verses about honor and dishonor are in the 12th chapter having to do with bhakti yoga. So just the same thing that we might say, why should you be a vegetarian? So we can say to someone, you should be a vegetarian for your health. You should be a vegetarian for the sake of the ecology. I mean, for your health, that's like a mode of ignorance, passion, reason. For the sake of the environment, that could be a mode of passion, mode of goodness, reason. You know, for the sake of ethics, so that's passion or goodness, probably passion, ethics and morality. And then you should be a vegetarian because that kind of food is what's pleasing to Krishna. Or you should be a vegetarian because it'll free you from sin. Oh, that's a mode of goodness reason. Maybe some passion. So we can give people all these reasons, and Prabhupada gave people all these reasons. But you can't really mix one with the other. They're from different angles because we as human beings, we respond to things from different points of view. What one person will, you know, depending on where we're situated. So if I'm situated in the mode of ignorance, a certain kind of argument will convince me. If I'm situated in the mode of goodness, a different kind of argument will convince me. So we may give all of these arguments.
That's why I want to congratulate you that as a devotee, you can have all these different lenses, speak from different point of view, and understand where a person is at. And it's only a Vaishnava, a devotee like yourself also can do that. And this is like mind-boggling for ordinary people that you can speak from so many different angles and perspective on the same topic. Coming to the point of the sons being the representative of the husband, I don't know if I missed the first part. I wonder if it was mentioned in the purport that because the sons are the representative of the husband. So
here it was actually, the purport said the opposite. Yet in this purport, because the women sent the sons to embrace Krishna, so the sons here are taken as the representative of the mother.
Oh, yes, right. That is quite interesting.
She sent the son, which represented herself. Whereas you can also say that the son's a representative of the father. And I gave the example there that Draupadi didn't want to kill Ashwatthama, although he had murdered Draupadi's children, because she considered Ashwatthama the representative of the father. And she said that as long as Ashwatthama's mother, Kripi, had her son, that she could bear the loss of her husband, Dronacharya. So sometimes the sons are usually described in Shastra more as an expansion or representative of the father. In this particular purport, they're being described as an expansion or representative of the mother.
Usually the younger son is more considered more, supposed to be doing the final rites for the mother. And the older one is for the father, according to Manu Samhita. But coming to another point, sorry, Mataji, taking your line, is that if they are using the faculty of imaginations or whatever you call it, I don't know. But, you know, in devotional service, we do devotional service with mind. So similarly, the queens are using that process. Not that it finishes there, but, you know, we can go deeper and
actually,
deeper.
These queens are not on that level. So let's look here, and I talked about this, I believe, in my last class. I know I talked about it very recently. There's two kinds of samadhi. One kind of samadhi is done on the level of mind, and it is ultimately a kind of imagination. Now, having said that, that is not to disparage attaining samadhi on the level of the mind. Just because it is still on the level of imagination doesn't mean that it's not valuable. It is valuable. Then there's another kind of samadhi that takes place on the platform of the soul. That is the reality. generally speaking, one first attains samadhi on the platform of the mind and then attains spiritual samadhi. This is explained in Nectar of Instruction, purport to text 8. It's also explained by Lord Kapila Dev when he says that the mind is used as a hook for catching the Lord. And that catching of the Lord, basically by using the mind to capture the Lord, the material mind then dissolves. The analogy given in this connection is that you use wood to create a fire, and the fire itself destroys the wood. So we use our mind, or the mind is the main reason we're taking birth after birth. Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, we're getting, I think it's in chapter 15, that we're getting life after life, a series of senses root around the mind. Yamadutas pull the subtle body, the mind, out of the body, and that subtle body, according to our thoughts, according to our thoughts, we get another gross body. So as long as we have a material mind, we are going to continue to transmigrate. So liberation means dissolving of the subtle body. How does the subtle body dissolve? If the subtle body is engaged only in spiritual thought, because the subtle body is made of material thought. That's what it's made of. Like the gross body is made of bones and blood. The subtle body is made of material thought. That's the building blocks. Well, if you just have spiritual thought, the material aspect starts to dissolve. Just like there's that old, Satyendra Marsh likes to tell this old Native American story where the grandfather is saying to his son, I have two dogs inside me, one that's vicious and mean and cruel and barking and critical and violent, and the other that's humble and kind and compassionate. And they're always fighting, and the boy says, which dog wins? And the grandfather says, well, whichever one I feed. So it's exactly like that. We have a material mind made of material thought. If we continue to hear material sound vibration, if we continue to dwell on, to contemplate material things, then we are feeding the material subtle body. But if I use that material subtle body, if I use the mind intelligence and the thought for their existence, and so the mind dissolves, and as the mind dissolves, my real mind awakens. Another analogy I can give you that's just my own personal analogy is if you had a paper package, and inside the paper package there's eggplant seeds. And let's say you took the whole package and you put it in water. The water would dissolve the package and cause the seeds inside to start to sprout. So that's what using the mind, manmana bhava madbhakto majaji mamimastri, that's what using the mind does. I use the mind to think of Krishna, even though it is undoubtedly imagination. There's no question about it. But it's imagination guided by Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, not mental speculation. There's the Shastra guides us in how to use the mind to meditate. It's meditation guided by the form of the deity. Meditation guided by the form of the deity in paint or in wood or in marble and by the descriptions of the Shastra. And such mental meditation will act as a hook to catch the Lord. And then he will appear personally. And then that samadhi will not be imagination, that samadhi will be of the reality. I'll give a couple of examples of that, and then I have to stop. So just like in the book Fascinating Womanhood, they said if you want to get your husband to do some work around the house that he's not doing, just start trying to do it yourself, and when he sees how bad you are, he'll come and do it for you. So it's something like that. If I'm putting all my energy into trying to meditate on the Lord with my mind, I can't actually meditate on the Lord with my mind. I can't do it. Even if I go at the speed of the mind, I can't catch Krishna. But if I'm trying my best to do that, then Krishna, having compassion upon me, does it actually. He comes and does it. right? Or just like one of my grandchildren here, when she turned 6, she asked my other son, her uncle, I want a computer for my birthday. And I said to him, you know, she already has a toy computer. When she gets mad, she throws it across the room. So first she has the toy computer. And after she plays with the toy computer and takes nice care of the toy computer, eventually somebody will give her a real computer. Of course, even what happens with the mind is ultimately real. Ultimately real. Because the mind is also one of Krishna's energies. This is very nicely explained, and I don't have time to read the whole thing. When Krishna meets the gopis at Kurukshetra, and he describes to the gopis how they should engage in jnana yoga, and they should meditate on him within all of the material elements, and meditate on him within the mind. And Krishna, and Prabhupada says there that the actions of the mind, they're also Krishna. Therefore, anyone who has the ability to think the mind is definitely in touch with Krishna. So even the actions of the mind, when done according to the prescriptions of the Shastra, are also real. Although on the mind, the act will remain unfinished. But these teachers were certainly not meditating on Krishna with a material mind. They were meditating on Krishna in the ultimate bhava samadhi. All right, I do need to go now. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Jai, all glories to Mother Rupila. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Prabhu's reminder, tomorrow Hanuman Prashik Swami is giving class.
Jai,
Haribo. Haribo, Jai, thank you. It was a wonderful class.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu.
Haribo.